session number 16808, reel 37.
Rest Fiddles, reel 37.
Yes, so being in the army all those years, it virtually created a new character, and of an independence. And so the big factories realised they got all these chaps coming out of the forces, and they really didn't know what to do with them. They couldn't give them their old job back, they couldn't sack somebody to make way for them. And it was fortunate that this problem in the boot factories of the closing rooms, they thought an opportunity here, so they offered to start men's closing rooms in the big factories. And Crockett's were no change, they jumped on the wagon. And so on the Friday, old Jack Robinson, the foreman, said to me, "We're going to start a men's closing room, Reg, over Turner Street," so, which was just round the corner from the main factory. He said, "Do you fancy it?" I said, "Sound fairy hand to me, Jack." I said, "I know all about stitching machines," I said, "since I was a kid." I said, "So, anyway," I said, "don't matter to me what we do." And this was the general attitude after the war. "I don't care what I do." I was prepared to do any job, whereas before the war, you always looked for a trade. But that was dead. You weren't looking for trades anymore. You were just looking for opportunities. It was a new man that had come out of the war. And so I said, "No, sound fairy hand to me, Jack." And so there was two of us out of the clicking room at Crockett's who had come back, and there were several lads from different parts of the factory. And initially, I think it was about eight of us. So we went over to Turner Street, and bloke named Wally Spence, who was the closing room mechanic, he was the old boy that used to look after the machines and keep them running. He'd been at work and set this, some of the machines up, and so we started going through the paraphernalia of chaps who'd never used a machine before, had to be taught how to use one. I mean, I was all right within a few minutes, because I said, I'd always been used to having them at home anyway. And always stitching up fishing bags for fishing and all sorts. And they're all patching machines, so it was no new thing for me, you see. But for the others, had never actually ever done any stitching in their life. But progress was made, and we started, and the weeks went by, and the months went by. And by the time I left there, I was about 5 years, and I left Crockett's to improve myself, as you eventually tried to do. And at that time, when I left, there was 40 men in this room doing all the work that the girls did. In other words, like doing work through, as we called it. So when the work came from the clicking room, it was all tied up, all the sections, the quarters and the vamps and the caps and the tongues, were all tied up separately in bunches. And then when they went down to the closing room, they were open. They went to a bench, which what they called the opening bench. And it used to be girls, it was now men, you see, in our room. And we had a couple of chaps there, and all they used to do, these bags used to come, linen bags with these work in, and they used to open it, and they got a work ticket attached to it, you see. And I'd open the bag, get all the stuff out, and the first thing I did was count it all to make sure it was all complete. And then they would dish it out to the various people in the closing room to do the various operations on these sections, and gradually they came together and made a complete upper in the closing room, you see. And then they were bagged up again, these uppers, completed uppers, and they went down into the making room where they were put onto lasts and the bottoms were put on and all that sort of thing, you see. But our job was just closing, you see. And so that's what happened. And by the time I left, we was employing about 40 in the room, and we'll be doing over 4,000 pairs a week of uppers through. In a job that before the war was predominantly accepted as women only. Men couldn't possibly do it, you see. And in vice versa, of course, you've got the situation at the end of the war where women were doing men's jobs, which previously they'd say, "Well, no, that's men's work," you see. But circumstances created a different atmosphere. And then you've got the same thing in the boot factories. You've got girls, because of the shortage of manpower, you got girls doing men's work. And then as chaps came back, where it was possible for a man to have his old job back, because there was a woman doing it, she had to be moved out, then the men moved in back in again because the law said it's got to be that way. And the creation of these women, when they was moved out, it was amazing. You know, they didn't want to go back to being a woman. They wanted to carry on doing man's work, like driving steam engines and things like that. You know, and it was amazing that the rearranging of the whole workforce in the country, you know. But that was the situation at Crockett. So I went in and went in this closed room, and I was there for about 5 years before I moved on to another factory. And purely to improve my financial circumstances. And but of course then we were living, by the time I'd done my, had my leave, 6 weeks, which I had, the eldest son-in-law, Harry, he was a regular from the from before the war. He was in the East Surreys, and he, just before the war started, he'd just finished doing his 21 years and was due to be released on pension. And they kept him over because of the emergency, and he carried on right through the war, which financially did him a good turn, because when the war started, he was a sergeant in the East Surreys. He took an opture after Dunkirk, which it was a period when a lot of people did this because of the lack of officers after Dunkirk, and he became an officer. And when he was demobbed, he was acting, he was a captain acting major. So pension wise he was sort of comfortably off. And he bought a house round the corner from where we are now in St Michael's Mount, which is a big house, much really too big for his requirements. And so we had two rooms with the wife's eldest sister and my brother-in-law, you see. And cooking arrangements, we lived in, as you might, as I used to call it, lived in, you see. But we had our own room downstairs and our own bedroom upstairs, you see. And we lived in that that situation for about 5 years, I would think. And then we had the opportunity to move out, because it was getting a bit crowded, because, I mean, our daughter was growing up, and Rose and Harry had got two children of their own, you see, who were growing up. And it wasn't that we were really crowded, but it was obvious that we had to move out sometime. And I got a cousin who lived down Knightley Road, and his house became available. So we moved down to there in Kingsthorpe Hollow for about 3 years as tenants in that house. And then, of course, we knew we'd got to come out sometime. And so we were looking for property to buy your own house, you see. That was the ultimate aim. And so we started looking around for a house and eventually finished up with this one where we're living in now. And so we've been here about getting on for 50 years now. And it's amazing when you think back, because when we bought it, it was £850, you see, and a 4% interest rate on the mortgage. And now, in the street, although they're not posh houses, they're just ordinary terraced houses, what we called three up and three down, where they've been modernised, as people tend to do, we haven't done that, but where people have tended to modernise, because the original people have sold the house and moved on to improve themselves, and it's usually young people setting up their first house that have come into these type of houses. But the first thing they've done is to upgrade them, have double glazing put in and walls knocked down and all that sort of thing, you see, and built-in cupboards and everything. And they raised the standard of the quality of the house. So now, in the street, houses are fetching down our street about £50,000, you know. And yet, we bought a house for £850. So it just shows you how things have changed over the years. But, so we eventually bought this house, and of course, having a baby, it meant that travel-wise, you were rather curtailed. So the need was to have a car. And again, problems cropped up after the war, coupons, petrol rationing, and all that sort of thing, you see. So we were living round the corner with the wife's sister, and there was a lad across the road, lived with his mother, and he was an ex-para, and Gilbert, and him and his mate, chap named I don't know now, I just call him John. Between them, they did what I've just said. Everybody wanted to have their own business. So they set up a business, and it's still going today. Whether John is still alive, I don't know. Gilbert emigrated, so I don't know what happened to him. And they set up a business, and they called it John's Garage. And that name is still there today in the town, John's Garage. And John was the worker. He was the mechanic. Gilbert was the flyboy. He used to have the job of going round, locating cars that had stood all the war, probably, needed some service in doing, and he was buying them at the right price for resale, taking them down to John. He was mechanically overhauling them, making them fit for resale, you see, on the second-hand market, and Gilbert was doing the buying and selling, and John was doing all the mechanic side, you see. And they had this place down Commercial Street, and I used to see these cars outside, and Gilbert understood that I needed a car, and along came this little Austin 7, commonly referred to by some people as the old puddle jumper, because they weren't very big, you see. They'd come to a puddle, they couldn't go through it, they'd jump over it, so they nicknamed them puddle jumpers. And I had this little Austin 7. It was actually 7.8 horsepower, and it was a side valve engine, very simple engine, and that, you know, and the petrol was a gravity feed petrol, there was no petrol pump in it. And I had it for about 7 years, and during that time, of course, I kept improving it, and got new tyres eventually and tubes. And Johnny Rowlands, who was one of our wartime yeoman, he was killed in Normandy, and I became friends with his mum and dad, and we used to visit. And Mr. Rowlands had got one which he'd bought brand new before the war, you see, and so he'd got lots of spares and knowledge of these little Austin 7s. And he worked at the Northampton Transport Corporation, and he'd started here. He was a Welshman actually, and he stayed on. We had the Welsh Fusiliers in the town during the First World War, and he married Mrs. Rowlands, and came to live in Northampton after the First War, when we had trams, you see, and he was a tram driver. Well, then when they changed over to buses, he was getting to the age where, you know, he wasn't really adaptable to change from trams to buses, so they put him in the garages, you see, doing whatever. I don't know what he did, but he worked in the garage down the depot, down Jimmy's End. And he was very helpful, you see, and at that time the buses were all hand painted. They didn't have sprays and that stuff those days, you see. It was all hand painted. And so he got the boss of their department that dealt with the painting of the buses and keeping them up to scratch, and he took my car down to Mr. Rowlands' garage, and he virtually stripped it right down to the metal so it looked like silver. And by the time he'd done it, he'd got about 7 layers of paint. Beautiful job it was, you know, it was really wonderful. And we transferred it from this drab black sort of base paint that it was on it originally, which they'd put on, John had put on just to make it look presentable. And it was all glossed up with this cellulose paint and everything. And we had it done in two-tone, blue and black, with a thin red line round the waist, because there was a little bulge that ran all the way around it, and he put this thin line about 3/8 of an inch wide all the way around, the demarcation line between the blue bottom and the black top, you see. Beautiful job it was. And I used to go down and see. It took him about a month to do it. He really did a good job, and he put 3 filling coats, as they called it, before he even started undercoating it. And first he put this first coat on, and then I wet, it's like emery paper, but it's like a wet cloth, and they rub it all off again, so it was back to silver. And then he put another coat on, and he did the same again. He did that 3 times, and what it did, you see, was totally fill all the pores of the metal and the flaws in the metal, so that when you put the undercoat on, it was definitely flat. And he put two undercoats, and then he put two top coats. And honestly, it was beautiful. It looked thick and solid, you know. And the wings, they through the vibration, they used to split. They were beaded wings. There was a metal, like a metal tube, really, inside the mudguard on the rim of the mudguard, which was sort of beveled in, you see. And through the vibration of these mudguards, which were separate in those days to the body of the vehicle, they used to split, they used to break at the point at the top of the bend of the mudguard, you see. So what he did, he sent me down to Grafton Street to a friend of his and who did body welding and all that. And he welded these cracks and ground them down so they become unseen anymore. And they were re-strengthened, you see, from inside the mudguard where it was unseen. And so when it finished painting it, there was no breakages anywhere. It was perfect, you know, beautiful job it was. Well, I paid about £90 for it, and I had it 7 years, and it was a proper little diamond it was when I resold it, and I sold it for £135 when I sold it. And they were proper utility thing. The seating, they were like inner tubes. Inside, it was all leather, the upholstery was all leather, and inside the back and the seat itself was like a thin motorbike inner tube, and it was went up and down like a what we call Chinese crackers, a zigzag all the way along, and they were all welded together so that you had a cushion of an inner tube that went up and down all the way, and you pumped them up, you see. And as the air gradually seeped, like they did with bicycle, any tube, you see, when it got a bit soft, you just got the old pump out, the foot pump, and pumped it up again, you see. So it was hard and firm, and you got a nice cushion to, and that's all it was, and the seats. And under the driving seat was a toolbox let into the base, which you just move the seat up, and there was your toolbox. And under the passenger seat was the battery, and the cable went through into the starter motor, you see, although it had a starting handle as well. And the petrol, the tank, was across the bonnet, across your lap virtually, inside the bonnet, and it held about 2.5 gallons of petrol. And same as the German Volkswagen, that was exactly the same system, a gravity feed, no petrol pump. And there's a tap inside the cab so that when you got in, you were going to switch it on, you just leaned over from the driver's side to the passenger side and turned the lever, and that allowed the petrol to start to run. And the petrol didn't run until you started the engine up, and the carburetor just took what petrol it needed, so it was just a gravity feed. And they had another safeguard, that this copper pipe that the tap was on, which was inside the bottom of the corner of the petrol tank, inside the bonnet itself, where you lifted the bonnet up on the side, there was another tap which was lower than the tap that was inside the car, and it provided you with a safety guard of not running out of petrol. And when you use the one inside, it used sort of 2/3 of the petrol in the tank, and then when the level of the petrol dropped below that tap, then you got no petrol coming. So you then lifted the bonnet up, turned the other tap on, which was lower down the point, and that gave you 6 points of petrol between that tap and emptying the tank completely. So you had a reserve in the tank of 6 points on this second tap. It's ingenious, really. And as I say, it was a carburetor only, no pump. And the petrol, of course, wasn't so pure in those days, so the jets used to sometimes get a bit muck in them, you see. And you used to buy these jets, they were little jets that you could buy down at Austin Work, because it was in Austin, you see. You go down Austin House, as they called it, in Abington Street, and you could buy these jets for about 9 pence each. So I had several jets, and it was not uncommon, you see. You'd be going along, and all of a sudden you'd go tip, 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 because there was a bit of dirt that had gone in there from the petrol, you see. So all you do is you switch off, go out, there's a little grub screw, You just got your screw driver, turned it, took the jet out, put a fresh one in, screwed it, and carried on, you see. Then when you got home, you got your foot pump out, and you blew the jet, the dirt out of that jet, and made it reserviceable, you see. So I always carried several jets. And so whenever you got a bit of a spasm, you know, you didn't have to bother about clearing the jet, you just took it out and put a new one in. A fresh one in, you see. And they were remarkable. And as I say, we ran this car, and where we went with it, fishing and that, and of course the younger brother-in-law, similar age to myself, just a little bit older, old Bill, he was fishing, you see. So we used to pile in this car with Bill and me and a wife and a younger sister and our daughter, you see, who was gradually getting older. And they always put all their fishing kit on it, you see, inside as well, you see. And it was a system. They used to get in, they used to put all the kit in, like, you see. And off we'd go for the day, either fishing or go out somewhere, you see. And of course the family was bigger those days, because there was more of them, more children involved. So after I'd sold it, to get the collateral to buy this house, you see, I needed money, you see, so I sold that, £135, and in those days that was sufficient for a deposit on a house that was going to cost me £850, you see. But that meant, of course, I hadn't got any transport anymore. But of course the daughter by now was at school, so she was growing up, so the urgency wasn't there the same. So I never ever had a car again the rest of my life, but I always drove, you see. And because I don't say I'm a teetotaler, but I never considered myself as a drinking man. In the factory and amongst friends, I came in demand for people saying, they go to a party and they say, would you drive it, Reg, you see? Because they knew I could go to either Tatum and they could lash up the deer, and then I was sober, so I could bring them home, you see, take them and bring them home. So I always came in for those sort of jobs with friends. And when I went to work at Gubbins, there was about half a dozen chaps there who were sort of what I call part-time fishermen. They didn't go regular like I did, but they liked to have a day out, you see. So periodically, they'd say, how about a day out, Red? And I'd say, yeah, all right then. When should we go? And I'd fix the date up. And I used to go round to Colwyn Road, round the corner, where there was a hire garage who hired out cars and minibuses and stuff like that, you see. Victoria Hire, it was called. And Frank Bamford, who was in charge of it, it was his wife's business actually, but he was like running it. And I knew Frank from days gone by, so I knew I could always go around there and get a car. So I say, yeah, righto. So I used to go, if they were sort of four or five of us, I'd go around there and get a big enough car, and we'd go down fishing down the drains, you see, or down the fens or somewhere. But if they all wanted to go at the same time, then I'd get a minibus, you see, which would be, say, about a 12-seater. And you get sort of seven or eight blokes with all the fishing kit. You needed the extra seats to put the gear in, you see. And so I would do that, you see. I would go and get the bus and all that. So again, I was driving a vehicle. And with the family, when it came to holiday times, the factories had the week's holiday, and that gradually updated to a 2 weeks holiday. It was the normal thing. And so what are we going to do? So well, Reg will get a minibus, you see. So I'd go around and get a minibus, and so for that fortnight, I'd be the driver, and we'd go day to day, one day fishing, another day we'd perhaps go to Alton Park or somewhere like that, you know, or some tourist spot, and we'd spend the fortnight with the use of this minibus. So again, I was still driving, you see. And so the years were going by and travelling on, and the daughter was getting older, and I said to the wife one day, Do you realise, I said, if Airy Lane came home, and it was becoming a sort of a feature then by now, that suddenly daughters were springing weddings on the parents without any pre-warning. I said, if Airy Lane was to walk in and say she was getting married in a month's time, I said, we couldn't pay for a wedding. You know, the money I was earning in the boot factory, because you see, my wife, once she had the baby, she never ever went to work. Well, you talk to people of my age group now, of their young life, and they talk about the holidays, where they went and all that, and you say, you had a car, and you always had a holiday, but the wives were always working, you see, so they had two incomes, and which they needed because they insisted on having holidays, they insisted on having a car. Well, we never insisted on either. My wife has never been a holiday bird, and always been content to take life as it was provided on my money. So with only one wage coming in, we've learned to live not a frugal life, but we've learned to cut our cloth according to requirements, you see, and we've quite happily lived like that. Well, I suddenly said, if the daughter came in and said she was getting married, we would not be able to afford to pay for it. So I said, it means one of two things. Either you've got to get a job, or I have to get another job. So, and as I'm working full time anyway in the boot factory, at Gubbins at this time, the surgical boot, we only worked a 5-day week, you see, Monday to Friday, where the big factories tended to work Saturday mornings, you see. So I said, well, what could I do? A second job, you see. How could I fit it in? And I suddenly realised that the taxi firms in the town were always advertising for part-time drivers. So I thought, well, that's the job, part-time taxi driver. Well, cutting a long story short, I finished up with a firm known as Nortax. And at that time, Nortax and another firm named Bounds were the two predominant taxi firms in the town. They run about a dozen cars at least, you see. There were other individual ones, but they were the two predominant ones, you see. So I went down to Nortax, who were on the Market Square at that time, their office, and went in and see one of the bosses, who turned out to be, again, an old schoolmate and street runner from the teenage days, Bernard Savage. And he was one of the two bosses who had bought this business from a firm of undertakers named Burbage in the town. And the son run this taxi firm, you see. Old man Burbage was the undertaker. One of his sons set up this taxi firm under the name of Nortax, you see, abbreviation for Northampton Taxis. And it used to cause a bit of comical relief, really, this nickname they had, Nortax. Anyway, before I digress too much, and so I went down, and lo and behold, it was Bernard Savage. So he said, hello, Reg, you know, and his family were a family of picture framers. They had a business up Seminole, and they used to do picture framing, you see. And he was part of that family, and he decided, like I said, people wanted to do their own thing after the war. They were less prepared to work for someone else. And so him and a chap named Frank Manning had got together. And again, Bernard was the office type man, and Frank Manning was the mechanic, you see. And it sounded strange. He was out of a tank lamp, you see. And they eventually had their own garage up Balmoral Road, Sears' old garage. The garage is still there. Frank Manning's son runs it now as a crash car business, you see. Frank's died and Bernard's still alive, but he's knocking on. And so I took on part-time, Saturdays only, with Nortax, you see. And I had a separate account at the Building Society to put my earnings in, you see, week by week, which was never very much, you see, because they used to pay half a crown an hour. And I mean, half a crown is only worth a few pence today. That was their going rate, you see, half a crown an hour plus tips, which you kept for yourself. And depending on the jobs you got or did, or your own character, depending on how your tips accumulated, you see. I mean, some blokes didn't do very good in the way of tips because they didn't have the aptitude to be civil or think of the passenger's requirements, you see. And if you did that, then you usually got better tips, you see. And so each week I used to put in probably about £3 in the Building Society. And the years went by, and the daughter never seemed as though she was getting married. She was knocking about with different chaps, you know, and that. But there was never any sort of vision of a marriage coming along, which suited me, because of accumulating the money to pay for the wedding. And the daughter did eventually get married to Dave, who's the son-in-law, and she was about 25, 26 before she got married, you see. And by that time, I'd accumulated about £400 in this account, you see, because working there part-time, initially Saturdays only, you found that these firms were run basically on part-timers. They had a permanent staff of drivers, but part-timers were necessary to keep the cars on the road all the time, you see. And